Welcome to Sputnik, orbiting the world with me, George Galloway.
And me, Gayatri.
Media lights are going out all over the world. They may not be switched on again in our lifetime. NATO is not just traditional weapons of war, but a vast, monstrous regiment of hacks whose salary and status is absolutely determined by the gusto with which they prosecute NATO's wars. In this one over Ukraine, I think for the first time, there is not the slightest chink in the armor. It is an ironclad consensus.
Using their control over big tech, they are literally bookburning in a frenzy of cancellation and deplatforming. In this part of the battle, at least, NATO has all the big guns.
One man and one outfit, not yet stilled, is Consortium News and its editor-in-chief, Joe Lauria. Joe, thanks for joining us. Am I right on this? You and I are of a certain age. We've been through a lot of wars. There is not a chink in the armor, is there? There is literally absolute support for NATO across the entire Western media.
Well, thank you for having me back, George. Last time I was on was New Year's Eve, and we were making predictions about 2022, and I said Ukraine would be the biggest story of the year. I was born just after the McCarthy period in the United States, and I always wondered what it would have been like to live through it, and I don't have to wonder anymore. In many ways, I think it might be worse. That targeted individuals who McCarthy said were communists inside the government, inside the army, inside Hollywood, this is a blanket destruction of any other point of view that's allowed to understand what's happening in Russia. And without that other side of the story, without at least being able to challenge what we're hearing, whether it's what's going on the ground, and I'm not going to pretend to know what's happening on the ground because I don't frankly believe either side, but the Western media believes and takes 100% the Ukrainian side. So we know that it's being portrayed as massive, deliberate targeting of civilians by Russia. And yet the UN reports only 500 and so died in the first 15 days of the war, whereas 1,700 people died in Ukraine of COVID-19 in the first 15 days. I'm not minimizing the deaths. Every death, of course, is tragic. But the portrayal that we're getting, it results from the complete shutdown of anything that questions this war narrative. And of course, we all know what happens during war with war narratives. And this is a very, very troubling development indeed. I think it came, we have a history, of course, in the United States in particular, after during the First World War, there was a mania against Germans. Everyone's familiar what happened to Japanese Americans. In the Second World War, they were interned, of course. And we began to see the beginnings of this anti-Russian hysteria beginning right after the 2014 coup in Ukraine and going into the Russiagate phantasmia that we were subjected to for years. And this set it up for us right now. By cutting out three major points of this story, George, it completely distorts what's happening. Number one, the coup that the U.S. certainly backed, the smoking gun evidence with that Victoria Nuland video, the fact that parts of the eastern Ukraine resisted that coup and wanted to stick with the democracy that they had taken part in electing a democratically elected president who was overthrown by violence. And then the Kiev regime, the new coup regime, war that they launched against this bid for independence. And of course, what happened in Donbass, the killings there, this is completely excised and whitewashed from Western media reporting. So what you're left with is the idea that a madman in the Kremlin woke up one morning and said, who am I going to attack today? Let me look on the map. Oh, I'll choose Ukraine and we'll take it. And of course, the other part is downplayed is the NATO expansion and the fact that Russia was the one that tried diplomacy back in December with draft proposals for treaties with NATO and the U.S., totally rejected by them. This war could have been prevented by the U.S. had they seriously negotiated that and had they told the Kiev regime that is clearly under the thumb of the United States to not attack Donbass in a new offensive. Of course, there's another pressure pushing on Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, that comes from these small in number but huge in influence, literal neo-Nazi battalions. That's the other thing that they have excised from the story, that there are literal self-declared Nazis wearing all the regalia. They played a huge role in that 2014 coup and in the killings that went on in Donbass when the Donbass resisted the coup, and of course having a huge role to play right now in this war. Zelensky's pressured by them, or politicians across Ukraine and who are not Nazis are pressured by these groups, and you can't mention that either. So there are no Nazis, there was no coup, and there was no offensive against Donbass. That was Russian invasion.
Well, here's the question that looms out of that, Joe. Not a lot of people know that, as Michael Caine once said, but all the journalists and broadcasters know it. So are they willfully deciding to excise all of that context that you have just given? Are they fools or are they knaves?
Could be both. I think some of them might not know it because they are subjected to what they've read in the media. However, in 2014, the BBC, the Daily Telegraph, CNN, even the New York Times ran stories about these neo-Nazi groups that, of course, extend back to Second World War. Stepan Bandera, the head of these fascist groups that at first joined with the Germans, with the Nazis, in destroying and killing thousands of Jews, particularly in the infamous massacre at Babi Yar. This was done by Ukrainian fascists. Of course, they wanted to set up their own independent fascist state in Ukraine. That's when the German Nazis turned against them. But after the war ended, the CIA worked with these groups. They set up offices in New York. And eventually, Stepan Bandera, who they still parade down the streets in Kiev and other Ukrainian cities with his banner behind in front of people carrying torches, can't make it up. He was assassinated in 1959 by the KGB. But the U.S. has been involved with these groups going back into the 50s, and they certainly have trained these guys. NATO has trained them. Ukraine is a de facto NATO state. Now, just to go back to your question, I think that some journalists should know that because they're early reporting, but they may have forgotten it. There are new reporters, but many of them are just, you know, want to keep their jobs going. I've worked a long time in mainstream media. I understand the pressures to conform to a certain story, a certain angle, a certain narrative, and that if you try to go around it, your job's in jeopardy. And I had many fights with mainstream editors over things, but I picked my moments. And fortunately, I've got out and I'm now editor of this great website that Bob Perry started in 1995, Consortium News. But so it's perilous being a journalist right now if you want to break with that narrative. You're not allowed to in the mainstream. And we are one of the outlets that continues to give a different context. The one I was providing is what we're giving every day to our readers.
How do you compare, Joe, the war coverage with other wars, really? I mean, the obvious one being the Iraq war.
Yes, I remember. The feeling now is it reminds me very much of that hysteria before the invasion of Iraq. All of the media put American flags, the TV stations, American flags that weren't there before. They composed new music and graphics, Desert Storm, etc. It was pure cheerleading. I remember a CNN anchor who was on a ship when the first cruise missiles were delivered onto Baghdad, and where people were on the other end of those missiles. And she was saying, "Welcome to shock and awe." That was her exact words. I was just horrified by that. This very much reminds me of that. But the other aspect is RT still existed, and there was a lot more anti-war feeling, all of those marches that took place. So while MSNBC fired their top-rated show, Donahue, because he was questioning the war, there was a lot of that happening then. I think this is more complete. One thing, it's much easier to just shut off somebody's access to the internet and publication on the internet. And that has become a lot more since 2003, clearly, the way and social media didn't exist at that time. So technology has certainly facilitated not only mass surveillance, as we learned from Snowden, but also mass censorship. And that's what we are experiencing right now. You cannot question the official narrative, and it's creating amongst the population a hatred for Russian people, not just for the government, and not just for Vladimir Putin. You have every right to oppose or question the legality of this invasion if you actually go through his arguments, Article 51, the theory of just war. You could come to the conclusion, but nobody's doing that. That is illegal. They're just saying it is illegal. But this is not, you're not allowed to question anything. And Americans and Europeans are hating Russians, where we have Tchaikovsky thrown off of a program where they tried to ban teaching Dostoevsky in a university in Italy, where we've seen conductors and opera singers being fired. This is unbelievable. This is something I've never experienced. But I guess it brings me back to the way Germans in the First World War were treated and the Japanese in the Second World War inside the U.S.
Well, I suppose then the only question that's left is, have they gone too far? Will the sheer mania of it all begin to make some people wake up and smell the coffee?
There might be some people in secretly smelling coffee and they're keeping their heads down, but I can't answer that for sure because I don't know where this is leading. I do know that the U.S., I believe the U.S. wanted this invasion and they set traps for Russia because otherwise they could not launch this extraordinary economic war against Russia, which is having a blowback on the West, which they didn't really figure out, but may in the end damage Western economies even more than Russia in terms of their relations with China. And they didn't bank on India, Latin American countries, even Middle East Gulf monarchies who are not joining in on the sanctions craze and who are not increasing petroleum output. So this situation is one that the West maybe needs to keep down this kind of censorship forever. I mean, I don't think RT for America, for example, ever come back again. They always wanted to shut it down, but they couldn't. The U.S. could end this war by having those negotiations over NATO and by telling Zelensky, you take the deal that's offered by Russia right now because you're going to lose anyway. Western military analysts know that eventually Russia will prevail and on the ground here. Take the deal where Donbass is our independent states, Crimea belongs to Russia, and Ukraine becomes a neutral country in your constitution. It has to be there, and you might even be able to stay in power. We don't know how far Russia will go, and I do hope that he doesn't continue, Zelensky, that is, to ask for NATO intervention because that is a disaster. And he has friends in the State Department and Blinken and Nuland. And Biden is between State Department and the Pentagon. State Department, Blinken and Nuland want no-fly zone. Pelosi in Congress wants no-fly zone. That the Pentagon knows that's direct war with Russia, with all the terrifying consequences that could bring. Pentagon are realists, and they're the ones who are going to save our lives maybe in the end of this. So Zelensky has to give up on this idea of asking for NATO intervention, whether that be Polish planes or a no-fly zone. He has to take this deal. Whether it is a surrender, it may be hard to swallow, but what the U.S., I believe, wants a ground insurgency as they did in this trap they set for the Soviet Union in Afghanistan when they armed the Mujahideen. And after 8 years, it certainly helped bring down the Soviet Union, what happened in Afghanistan. And the aim here is to bring down Putin's Russia with bleeding Russia further economically and on the ground in Ukraine. So that's what I'm afraid of. If that happens and this becomes a prolonged war, this censorship that we're seeing, and some of it will never be reversed with the insanity of it, it's really... We're living in mad societies now, George. I think that will continue for the long term.
Joe Lauria, thanks for joining us on board the Sputnik.
Appreciate it, George. Thank you.
Coming up next, how it all began. The view from the Donbass. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back. The war in Ukraine began not last month or even last year, but 8 long and bloody years ago, and 14,000 Ukrainian citizens were slaughtered there. Not by Russia, but by other Ukrainians, by the Ukrainian armed forces and their vanguard in the neo-Nazi battalion.
But not a lot of people know that, and those that do are determined to conceal it. The security analyst, Mark Sloboda, is one of those determined that the truth will out. He joins us now from Moscow. Mark, thank you for joining us on board the Sputnik. It is true, isn't it, that it began in 2014, but it's also true that not a lot of people know that. How did that come to pass?
Yeah, George, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Sputnik. The conflict in Donbass began really essentially almost immediately after the overthrow of the government in Kiev by the U.S.-backed Maidan putsch. It is presented as a revolution of dignity, this buzzword that's used as if some people have dignity, but others don't. Now, despite polling at the time reported in the pro-Maidan, then American-run Kiev Post, that repeated polls showed that a majority of Ukrainians, a bare majority, but a majority opposed the Maidan, it is presented as democratic. However, the people of Ukraine, of Eastern Ukraine, particularly in the Donbas, where they had overwhelmingly elected Yanukovych to be their president, they never accepted the overthrow of the president. They began to organize almost immediately to form their own militias and to drive out, what were already the nascent battalions of the Maidan that were sent east to seize control of government buildings, just like they had in Kiev. The Ukrainian army had almost fallen apart. They were refusing to follow orders from Kiev. And particularly in East Ukraine, there were tens of thousands of defections from the military, the police, the security services, people who defected or just, essentially quit and retired. They did not immediately follow orders from the new regime. And you don't have to take my word on it. You can refer to Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, whose report on it said that 75% of the Ukrainian Navy's personnel either quit or defected to Crimea and on to Russia. So they sent the battalions in their place. These were the fighters of the Maidan, the so-called self-defense forces that were headed by the arch neo-Nazi Andrei Perubi, who had co-founded the Social Nationalist Party of Ukraine. He was the head of the Maidan Defense Force, and he's the one who sent these nascent battalions before becoming speaker of the new Rada to the Donbas. The military units, the few responsive ones, when they went there, they were met by the people of East Ukraine just coming out of their buildings, right, putting their bodies in front of tanks and protesting, saying, "What are you doing here?" The military didn't respond. So those units were withdrawn, they were disbanded. And then the battalions were sent in, and these were the far right. These were Azov, the right sector, at the time, Idar, Tornado, et cetera. There was a large number of them. But they began the conflict in earnest. And the way they did it is simply by using artillery to shell the cities of Eastern Ukraine and Donbas from afar.
Most people watching this will now be familiar with the Azov battalion, even though most other people are not. But tell us about this Tornado battalion. This seems to me a largely untold story.
Yeah, it is another far-right battalion, and it has been cited by mainstream Western humanitarian rights organizations for committing war crimes, crimes against humanity, torture, kidnappings, summary executions, in the like, in Eastern Ukraine. They were ostensibly disbanded after 2015, but in reality, they have been regrouped back together in large effect, almost as a discrete unit within the Ukrainian regular military.
Now, after all that's happened, and I don't just mean in the last 4 weeks, but in the last 8 years, it's inconceivable that these people could go back to living in the Ukrainian state, isn't it? The Minsk Agreement, which Russia supported and demanded that it should be implemented, is now dead and buried, isn't it? Because that presupposed these areas, now independent republics, would remain within the state of Ukraine.
Yeah, there's always been a big cultural divide between social political divide between West Ukraine and East Ukraine. But the events of the last 8 years, these deaths, the dehumanization of the people of the Donbas by the new regime in Kiev. First, they called them terrorists, and then they were referred to as pro-Russian separatists, as if that somehow makes them less human beings. And often they were just referred to as, you know, Russians themselves. And it was denied that there was a actual civil conflict in Ukraine. That's part of the legitimizing myth of the putsch in 2014. Everyone in Ukraine agreed with the overthrow of the government. And anyone who didn't were just pro-Russian separatists and had no legitimacy whatsoever. Well, after these 8 bloody years living half in and out of their basements in Donetsk and Lugansk, the first president of the Maidan putsch regime in Kiev, the candy oligarch Petro Poroshenko, famously said recorded that you can watch on YouTube, that the children of Kiev under their control will go to school play outside, while their children, talking about the people of Donbas, will live huddled in their basements. And that's how we'll win this war. And that kind of genocidal ethnic cleansing rhetoric, is exactly why the people of Donbas really can't in any conceivable way see themselves returning to a Ukraine where so much of this was permitted, excused, encouraged. And with Russia's official recognition, just over a month ago, of the Donetsk and Lugansk national republics as independent states, it is likely that they will never return. In fact, one of the key demands of Russia's intervention in Ukraine right now is to force the regime in Kiev to recognize not only that the Crimean people chose to become part of Russia in a referendum, but that Donetsk and Lugansk are now independent states and no longer part of a Ukrainian state.
Mark, in the West, we are told that there's an exodus of Russians trying to flee. And they are looking with envy at the Ukrainians because the Ukrainians are being received with open arms, but not the Russians. To what extent is this true?
Yeah, it's true, although it's often blown out of proportion. There is and has long been a fringe pro-Western extreme minority in Russia. You could call them Navalny supporters, pro-Western liberals. And, polling wise, they represent somewhere between 2-3% of the Russian population. But they are extremely passionate about their views. And, they are the most active, in terms of protests. Well, now, instead of protesting, a lot of them are simply choosing to leave. And there has been an exodus, I would say in the thousands, maybe the low thousands, but this political type, particularly they are going to the Georgian capital of Tbilisi, the Armenian capital of Yerevan, and some to Kazakhstan, because these are countries where Russian citizens do not need a visa, and they are more or less Russian-speaking countries where they might be able to, at least temporarily or maybe permanently build more new lives in a place where they feel more politically comfortable. Although that's a question mark, considering particularly Kazakhstan and, pro-Russian alignment of Armenia geopolitically. But and it is what it is. Okay, so there are polls out by the government pollster, which have always pretty much been more or less in lockstep with independent pollsters, that are showing right now that somewhere between 70 and 71% of the Russian people support Russian military intervention in Ukraine. There is an independent poll that has been done and reported in the Washington Post. They are really sketchy about how it was carried out, who actually performed it, They've come up with a different number of 58%, both polls showing roughly 20% opposed. So somewhere at least between, 58 and 70%, if you want to split it in half, you've still got a clear majority of the Russian people supporting it, with about 20% in general opposed to it, and the rest forming an indecisive on the answer.
It's odd that, though, because we're told that Russia is a dictatorship. They seem to have missed the elections that periodically and regularly occur. But as I've seen on Russian television and in Russian newspapers, there is fierce debate about the course of action that Putin has undertaken.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a long tendency, in Western, particularly U.S. Political circles, to demonize any country that is not aligned with them geopolitically as not being democratic. And personally, being originally an American myself, I don't think that they really have the moral or the political systemic right to judge other countries' democracies as being less so than theirs, with the electoral college, the two corporate-backed political parties, campaign finance corruption, and so on. But they've declared that, the Russian people are all brainwashed. They don't know what they're doing. And, this is a normal type of othering and demonization of an entirety of people, and that their political views are not legitimate. But it doesn't change the facts on the ground. And, unless there are significant, a complete collapse of the Russian economy or, really enormous losses in Ukraine, I don't see those numbers changing. In fact, Putin's approval rating has actually jumped as a result, even higher than the support of the war. It was some 58% before this all began, just over a month ago, and it's now up to 74%. Wow. So despite the intended effect of the sanctions by the West, it's having the opposite result. There is a rally around the flag effect, and people are generally supporting their military and supporting the president.
Mark Sloboda, thank you for joining us on board the Sputnik.
Thanks for having me.
Well, alas, that means it's the end of the show.
But you can stay in touch with us on our social media. On Twitter and Instagram, it's @RT_Sputnik. Or on Facebook, Sputnik on Russia Today. It's goodbye from me, Gayatri.
And from me, George Galloway. It's been marvellous.